Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon. Look for a high today of 92. That would be 10 degrees warmer than average. We'll be up to 97 for tomorrow, then back to 89 on Thursday. Sunny skies, 86 degrees at KJZZ. And quickly checking Valley traffic, 60 westbound. A crash at Stapley has the right lanes blocked. And on the 17 southbound, an accident at Glendale Avenue. Until this week, state lawmakers recently had been voting on bills and sending them to the governor at a pretty steady clip, but now they're not, and there are about 9.5 billion reasons why. To explain, I'm joined by Ben Giles. He covers the state Senate for Arizona Capital Times. And Ben, it seems like things were moving along, and then they weren't.
No, we had a directive from the governor this weekend that he doesn't want to see any more bills on his desk until there's a budget deal in place. We're getting a little long in the tooth in the session, and this has been a tactic that's been used before. Governor Jan Brewer issued the same order to lawmakers while she was in office that, hey, stop what you're doing and let's start focusing on a budget. We're rapidly approaching the 100th day of session, and it's time to do the constitutional duty of the legislature, which is adopt a spending plan.
Well, how close are the governor and the House and Senate to having something to show to members and then vote on?
I think the more important question at this point might be how close is the Senate and the House? We've heard that relationships between the ninth floor, the governor's office, and the Senate are pretty good, and that those negotiations seem to be going smoothly. But what's been more concerning to folks at the Capitol is how negotiations between the Senate and the House are progressing. And we've seen some preliminary budget numbers that show the House and Senate might not be as far apart as was previously thought, maybe about $18 million as far as baseline spending goes in the next fiscal year. But what we've also heard is there are several priorities of House Speaker David Gowen, who's also a congressional candidate in CD1, and that the budget that the House wants to get approved might change dramatically from the numbers that we've already seen.
Do you get the sense that the numbers are vastly different, or how they're allocated is what's different?
I think it's pretty close as far as the allocation. I think what the difference is going to be, and as the budget process drags on, always seems to be the case, is people's pet projects and people's special spending for their district. And those are the kind of asks and requests that seem to pile up the longer negotiations take place. But I think as far as the baseline spending for a variety of agencies, a lot of that stuff is formulaic anyway and won't deviate too much between the chambers and the ninth floor.
Do you have a sense of what some of those differences might be?
There's a lot of talk about education funding, particularly for higher ed, for universities. There was about roughly $100 million in cuts adopted in the budget last year for Arizona's three public universities. And there's been a big push, particularly among some moderate Republicans at the Capitol, to restore more of that funding than Governor Ducey proposed, which was just about $8 million. And some cuts to K through 12 that have been proposed and kind of put off every couple of years, there's probably going to be a push for some delays in those cuts as well, especially with Prop 123 coming up.
So among the people with whom you're speaking at the Capitol, how do they see this ultimately playing out?
Some of the whispers at the Capitol we're getting, Mark, is that the budget could come together pretty quickly. Probably not this week, as negotiations are still ongoing, and particularly because there's some lawmakers who are absent from the Senate this week, and there's a very slim margin for error there in the Senate with only 30 lawmakers and 18 Republicans. So there's going to need to be a full slate of senators and representatives to vote on this, perhaps as soon as next week. But certainly this budget is not shaping up to be as short or as speedy as the 2015 legislature.
Have the budget plans that have been circulating, do they give us any sense as to what kind of tax cut the governor might be thinking about for this year?
Yeah, what we've seen is kind of a hold for $30 million in a tax package But just as last year, Governor Ducey is promising tax cuts, but not actually telling the public how that's going to be accomplished as the budget process goes on. But yeah, there's about a $30 million hold in the budget right now in the figures we've seen. And presumably, that would be for whatever sort of tax cut package the governor has in mind. But again, he's not telling us what that is.
Ben Giles covers the state Senate for the Arizona Capital Times. Ben, thanks as always.
Thanks, Mark.
Arizona has been through a number of city versus state conflicts of late, but they're not especially unique. Battles are happening in North Carolina over minimum wage rates, in Texas over immigration, and in Maryland, where the governor cut off Baltimore's multi-billion-dollar light rail project. Alan Greenblatt, a reporter for Governing Magazine, has looked into what's happening and why, and he joins me now. Alan, some people point out that state governments put the kind of pressure on local governments that they don't want to get from federal officials. How is that viewed in the broader sense?
There's an expression in government, where you stand depends on where you sit. And so it's exactly the case that if you're a progressive and you see a conservative governor or state legislature stepping on a city's prerogatives, you say, of course, they're hypocrites. Like you said, they complain about Washington doing the exact same thing. In my article, I talk about Greg Abbott, who's the governor of Texas, and he really made his name suing the federal government all the time when he was a state attorney general and complaining about overreach and federal intrusion. And now as governor, he complains about the state being Californiaized, as he put it. And he's blocked cities from having fracking bans. It does seem hypocritical. So what he would tell you, though, is that he's trying to preserve liberty for the people wherever they live, and he was fighting against an onerous government at the federal level, and now he's fighting against onerous governments at the local level.
So the Obama administration, because of some of the conservative leanings of many state legislatures, has gone to the cities in a lot of cases. Is there any degree of resentment, this idea that people are looking to the cities for more creative ideas, and legislatures say, well, you can't really afford to be creative right now, so stop it?
It's not that they're mad that cities are implementing ideas. It's more the types of ideas that are being implemented. In general, a lot of the ideas that the administration has been promoting using cities as partners have been things that a lot of state legislators, governors, object to. For instance, refugee resettlement, paid sick leave, minimum wage increases. These are ideas the administration couldn't sell in Congress, which, of course, is controlled by Republicans. So they look to the venue that was most amenable, which was big cities. And, you know, right now, I think the number is 22 out of the 25 largest cities have Democratic mayors. It's something like 75% of the 100 largest cities have Democratic mayors. Democrats rule the cities, and it's not just that they have mayors installed, but that's where the votes that elected Obama president, that's where his voters live, tend to be in the big cities. So, it's like I said, I don't think Republicans are jealous and wish they were getting a call from the White House. I don't know if they'd want to take a call from this president, but they don't want to see his policies implemented within their state.
Alan, has the city versus state tension become noticeably worse after the Great Recession?
So if you're in San Francisco, Seattle, Austin, Boston, some of these cities are just doing fantastically. By comparison, a lot of the country really has never come out of the Great Recession. It's a fight over resources. So if you're thinking of the big picture of the state, what is best for the state, you might think, I need to invest where there's possibility of growth. If Phoenix is doing great, that's where we should put money. You know, if it makes sense to concentrate your efforts where you've got the biggest bang, because right now our economy seems to like what they call clustering with great minds gathered in one place. You know, GE just announced it's moving its headquarters from the kind of rural Connecticut to Boston. And the CEO just the other day of General Electric said when he walks out the door, he doesn't want to see a deer. He wants to be challenged by an MIT grad. The sort of knowledge industries, technology, so forth, medicine, engineering, they all want to be in the downtown. So maybe it makes sense to encourage that and get those jobs there. However, if you're in a county that's struggling, that's seen its one manufacturing plant close, that where unemployment is high, where maybe there's a problem with opioid addiction, why is the state sending resources, money, my money, why is it sending money to the big city, which already has so much? Why aren't you taking care of me?
Alan Greenblatt is a writer for Governing Magazine. We've been talking about the fights between states and cities over a lot of different issues. Alan, thanks.
Well, thanks for having me.
The Flagstaff Needs a Raise political committee has officially launched its effort to get a measure on the ballot asking Flagstaff residents to increase the city's minimum wage to $15 an hour by 2021. That's despite Governor Ducey's signature on a bill that would take away a city's state-shared revenue if it passes an ordinance that's in conflict with state law. Joe Bader is a spokesman for the group pushing the higher minimum wage in Flagstaff, and he joins me. So, Joe, what have you found so far as folks have been out gathering signatures to try to get this on the ballot?
This is an extremely popular issue and initiative. Everyone is signing. Virtually no one refuses to sign. When we present them with the initiative petition and explain that we're going for an increase in the minimum wage in the city of Flagstaff to $15 an hour over 5 years.
Are you concerned that your efforts are illegal under that new state law that Governor Ducey signed?
No, Governor Ducey has no authority whatsoever to sign such a law. I wasn't aware that he signed that law. I remember that he threatened cities who passed minimum wage initiatives that he threatened to take away state funds. This is in the state constitution. The voters' will trumps the governor's wishes. The voters in 2006 amended the constitution in Arizona by passing Proposition 202, which allows cities to set their own wages and benefits. And that's the law. That's the current law now. The governor can't overturn that.
Assuming, though, that you get this on the ballot and it is approved, Would you expect a lawsuit coming from the state?
Well, we expect them to try anything, Anything's possible.
Do you have the resources, though, if you need to fight this initiative and fight this ordinance in court? Do you have the resources to do that?
Yes, we do. We have lawyers that are dedicated to this. The same attorneys that represented us on the lawsuit last year will represent us again, as well as other attorneys. And we have resources in order to fight that.
So it sounds like that you had planned to do this regardless of what the governor did with what cities are calling the Punish Cities Bill. This is, it sounds like, was not sort of an attempt to provoke the state. This is just you doing what you had been planning to do all along.
No, we have been planning to do something. That's why, I mean, we filed the lawsuit last year in order to clear the deck, you know, and the Attorney General, Mark Brnovich's office, agreed with our lawsuit. Remember that. He settled the case with our attorneys and agreed that Flagstaff had the right to set its own minimum wages and benefits in accordance with the Constitution as amended by the voters in 2006. So, yes, we had always planned to try to take some action to address the issue of low wages in Flagstaff and raise the minimum wage.
Joe Bader is a labor policy expert and a spokesman for the Flagstaff Needs a Raise Political Committee. Joe, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mark.
From the world of sports to beyond, everyone is talking about what happened last night in Houston.
3 seconds to go across the timeline. 2 seconds to go. Jenkins, three, right wing to win it. He made it! He made the three from the right wing at the buzzer. Cats win it all!
That's how it sounded on Villanova student radio as the Wildcats won it all on a last-second three-pointer to beat North Carolina in an epic NCAA title game in Texas. And next year, that could happen right here in Arizona as the men's Final Four returns to the Valley and the West for the first time since 1995. KJZZ's Phil Latzman is here with the woman in charge of next year's event.
Yeah, Mark, Dawn Rogers is executive director and CEO of the Final Four coming to University of Phoenix Stadium in Glendale in 2017. She's on her way back from Houston after attending last night's game. So how well does this position our region for next year, Dawn?
This entire week that we've been here in Houston, what we keep hearing repeatedly is we can't wait to come to Phoenix. And then watching that classic game last night, I think just adds to the excitement of the event coming to Phoenix.
How does this benefit the bottom line of the average Phoenician or Valley resident knowing that this event comes a year from now?
Well, I think that, you know, I think there are a number of benefits. One, it's the opportunity to really showcase this iconic event here in our state where it's never been held. And so for people to be able to experience it, there's only 10 cities that can even host the event. You know, the direct spending for our state is not insignificant. The exposure that our state will receive this entire entire year, and especially that week, not only across the country but also internationally, is a benefit to everyone that lives in the state because it enhances our brand and our visibility.
This is the first time the Final Four will be here since 1995, and very few and far between do we even have Final Fours or NCAA championships out west. Why is that? Why does it seem so rare that college basketball, which has such a rich tradition in the West, why do you think the West hasn't had these events?
Well, the biggest reason is that we haven't had a facility that is large enough to be able to hold the event. You now have to have 60,000 seats in a venue to be able to bid on the event. So we in Arizona, we weren't even able to bid on it until University of Phoenix Stadium opened in 2007. And so after Seattle demolished their facility, there has been no venue in the West. And I think that was one of the reasons that the NCAA and really wanted to be able to come West. They're very excited. We had meetings all week here. We've already started our marketing planning. The membership is really eager to come West.
Dawn Rogers is executive director and CEO of the Final Four coming to Phoenix next year. Dawn, thanks for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That's KJZZ's Phil Latzman. The immigration crises in Europe and here in the American Southwest have inspired powerful polarized reactions. In this country, we've seen increased deportations and a groundswell of support for more fences on the border. In Europe, borders have been closing and anti-immigrant backlash has been building. There's no easy solution. But on both continents, some people see it as their duty to help these needy populations. This is the story of two churches trying to work together half a world apart. KJZZ's Dina Sieg reports.
Marta Bernardini is walking just a few feet from the tall, rusted wall that separates Nogales, Arizona from Nogales, Mexico. But she doesn't like to look at it.
We want to separate the people and say we are better than you because we are in the right part, in the right side of the wall, the rich part of the wall, and you are in the poor part.
Bernardini is on the Mexican side this morning. She's used to these kinds of divisions, just not man-made ones. Her home is on Lampedusa, an Italian island where the border is the rough, churning ocean. She's a social worker there for migrants on behalf of the Federation of Protestant Churches in Italy. Now she's nearing the end of 4 months spent on these borderlands as she learns how people are helping migrants here. Bernardini reaches El Comedor, a tiny dining hall run by various churches where women are washing up dishes before serving a free breakfast to a crowd waiting outside.
This is a place for remember the dignity of the people. So I think it's very close to our work on the island of Lampedusa because with our presence at the dock, we try to humanize the dock and the border.
With blankets, smiles, and hot tea. According to the United Nations, more than 1 million people arrived in Europe by sea last year, many in Lampedusa.
This world is changing dramatically.
Randy Mayer has seen it firsthand. He and his wife are hosting Bernardini, and she hosted them last year on Lampedusa. Mayer's the pastor at Good Shepherd United Church of Christ in Suarita, Arizona. It was important for him to travel to Italy, Mayer says, not just to learn, but to stand in solidarity.
People of faith and people of conscience need to really continue to fight the good fight.
Mayer started a humanitarian group years ago that still leaves water, food, and clothing on desert trails well worn by crossing migrants. But for him, the good fight is also about exposing people like Bernardini to what Mayer calls the militarization of the U.S.-Mexico border.
In this country, in the last 10 years, we've tried security and walls, and we really haven't tried any of the humanitarian solutions as a government.
There have been a record number of deportations, Mayer says, as well as more Border Patrol checkpoints and agents.
How can we help other countries not go down that path?
Bernardini worries about that potential future constantly. She says things are changing quickly in Italy, and she feels increasing anti-immigrant sentiment from the government. So-called economic migrants are being deported, while only people deemed refugees are allowed to legally stay.
This is not a way for a country, for a civil country, to treat the people. Because Europe was built on the idea of defending the human rights of all the humanity.
Bernardini does see a glimmer of hope. Churches of various denominations in Italy have banded together to bring groups of migrants with especially high need into the country legally through something called the Humanitarian Corridors Project. Last month, the first Syrian refugees arrived in Italy by air instead of the dangerous sea journey. The program is planning to give visas to 1,000 people. Bernardini knows that's not many.
But it's a starting point. It's an example for other countries, for other realities, for other churches, for other organizations to say, we can do something in a different way.
But at this point, that way can only help a tiny percentage of the 100,000 migrants who've already arrived in Europe this year. That's more than 8 times the number from the same time last year. This week, Greece began sending the migrants who land on its shores to Turkey. Italian officials have said they're looking for a similar deal. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News.
It's almost time for the next episode of The Quiz Show. That's when we bring back our resident quizmaster and Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions winner, Leszek Pavlovich. He'll face off against a KJZZ staff member in a game of trivia, but you can get in on the action too. Just solve this puzzle. A street has 100 buildings. They're numbered from 1 to 100. How many nines are used in these numbers? When you have the answer, email us at theshow@kjzz.org. We'll randomly draw 2 names from the correct answers, and either Leszek or one of our KJZZ newsroom staffers will play on your behalf. If your player wins, you'll win a special KJZZ item. When Mesa police officer Philip Mitchell Brailsford was charged with the murder of an unarmed man last month, he was wearing a body camera when the shots were fired. Now, one expert who studied the Mesa Police Department's use of body cameras when they first started using them in 2012 tells KJZZ he's surprised by the case because the footage exists in the first place.
It's rare that there's any video footage attached to situations that involve lethal use of force.
Justin Reedy worked at ASU's School of Criminology and Criminal Justice when he conducted the study. Now he's a criminology professor at Griffith University in Queensland, Australia, and that's where KJZZ's Lauren Gilger got a hold of him. Hey, Lauren.
Hey, Mark.
So why does Reedy say this footage is so rare? Isn't this why police departments want their officers to wear body cameras?
It is. Since the shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014 sparked some heated protests, more and more police departments across the country have started having their officers wear body cameras. A lot of pundits at the time seemed to think that if the officer had been wearing one of those cameras, a lot of the civil unrest that followed could have been avoided. But Reedy says lethal situations like the one that happened in Mesa are a tiny fraction of all officer-citizen interactions.
The big thing that the media and the current administration is thinking about is the way that technology can impact police officers, especially in lethal force or potentially lethal situations. The amount of lethal force that occurs in a given year is very small, proportionally speaking, even in large departments. So it's important to remember that physical force, police use force in only about 1% of police-citizen interactions. And lethal force situations occur in a fraction of those 1%.
And he says in the study, officers also didn't activate their cameras all the time, even when there was a mandatory activation policy in place. So footage like this is really rare.
So this Mesa footage was a part of the county attorney's office's investigation into Officer Brailsford, and now he's being charged with murder, so it seems like this kind of footage can actually make a difference in a case.
And wearing the camera in the first place can change how officers behave, according to Reedy. Mesa police actually reached out to him to do the study, he said, and in it they had 50 officers in the field wear cameras and then compared them to a control group of 50 officers who didn't, and they found the cameras caused officers to generally be much more risk-averse than they would have been otherwise.
One of our key findings was that officers who wore cameras were much slower to initiate stop-and-frisk field interrogations. And we're not sure the exact reasons why this happened. One possibility is that officers who were wearing cameras were thinking much more carefully about the legal requirements, reasonable suspicion. before they initiated stops.
Not only that, but Reedy says body cameras also seem to make citizens think twice about their actions.
We've had lots of situations where officers on the street were notified or informed citizens that a camera was rolling, and citizens definitely kind of calmed down, de-escalated the situation, became less confrontational.
So it was clear to Reedy that this technology could really make a difference and increase accountability for everyone.
Well, Lauren, does he think these cameras could help solve some of the divisions between the community and police officers?
So that's where he draws the line. Reedy told me it's a mistake to think that having an officer's body camera video in a case will give you the truth.
A video gives you one perspective, and one perspective only. It's only several pieces of a larger puzzle. We don't know a lot of things that happen during police-citizen interactions, even when we have the video recording.
We haven't seen the body cam video in the Mesa case yet. It hasn't been released, but Reedy says seeing what's in an officer-worn video probably won't mean everyone will agree about what they saw in it.
We really have to be cautious in assuming the technology is going to bring communities and the police together. Right, this idea that it's going to bring consensus. I think that's a fallacy. It's not going to bring consensus. And in fact, a lot of times with video recordings of police-citizen interactions, what it has the potential to do is create more division. Because people who have these entrenched views, whether it's for the community or for, or against the police or whatever, are going to be more entrenched in their views because they're going to selectively view the video footage and view that in a way that's going to support the pre-existing views about what happened.
That was Justin Reedy, who was a professor at Arizona State University's School of Criminology and Criminal Justice when he conducted a study on the Mesa Police Department's use of body cameras for officers.
That's KJZZ's Lauren Gilger. Lauren, thanks.
Thanks, Mark.
If you see a storm coming, you have a couple of options, which can be compatible. You can let other people know while also going inside. The National Weather Service's Phoenix office started offering occasional classes last month, training non-meteorologists on how to recognize a storm and how to properly pass the information along. Meteorologist Austin Jamison is one of the sky-worn spotter instructors. We met at the Weather Service's office near Papago Park and started by talking about the initial steps for getting the public involved.
Job number one is protection of lives and property, and we do that through our forecasts so that if people know about hazardous weather, they can take measures to protect themselves and their property, or they can know to avoid that area to avoid dangerous conditions. And we have a lot of technology like satellites and radar and ground-based weather stations, but it turns out there's still some things it takes the human eye to be able to confirm and detect. So, for instance, we can be very certain that a storm, or have a lot of confidence that a storm is going to produce damage, wind damage, for instance, or flooding or what have you, but we don't know for sure if it did. We don't know what the extent of it was. Spotters provide what we call ground truth information.
When it comes to training folks who come to your classes, do you get people who have any background at all, and is that important? Do you have to really know, I mean, other than what any of us as a human being would know about the weather, do you have to know anything else, or do you really start from the basics?
Right, we start from the basics. You don't have to already have a baseline set of knowledge in meteorology. We teach you everything you need to know to be a successful spotter. So we cover thunderstorm structure, and then we drill down into key visual clues that indicate strength and severity of the storms. And then we delineate what kind of weather hazards are of particular importance and what is particularly important to report, and then how to report it. So in a two-hour class, they get, you know, everything they need to know to be successful.
And you also make it clear to them, hey, when you're telling us what's going on, if there's lightning around your house, don't stand right around and do that, right? Basics like that.
Right. That's also part of the presentation is safety information. We talk about lightning safety, flooding safety, dust storm driving safety. So that's all part of the presentation. And spotters don't need to be chasers. In fact, we are in the safety business, and we say, reporting storms is best done from within safe shelter. So you don't need to be a chaser to be a storm spotter.
And do you need any special equipment or just your eyes?
Right, that's it. It's really your eyes or your equipment. And the trained eye is the equipment we're looking for, so you don't have to have all this different weather equipment.
Considering the Valley itself is a community of millions of people, Is there an ideal number of spotters you'd really like to have? Can you tell me how many you have now who've been officially sort of deputized, if you want to put it that way?
So our forecast area goes well beyond Phoenix. Covers portions of Arizona and even a little bit of California. So we have some 31 or 2,000 miles of territory that we cover. So right now, the people that we have on our roster is in the neighborhood of 2,700. And probably some of those are more keen and aware of the weather and more apt to report than others. And so we'd like to, you know, make sure people are keeping an eye to the sky as much as possible. And given the localized nature of the severe weather, we want to have as dense a coverage as we can. You know, the Phoenix area obviously has a lot more people. It's a more dense area, so that's where the spotters are concentrated. But we would certainly like to grow our numbers outside of the Phoenix area, in rural areas especially, you know, La Paz County, Yuma County, Pinal County, Gila County, and even out into California.
National Weather Service meteorologist Austin Jamison. The next open skywarn spotter class is scheduled for April the 19th in Maricopa.
Here's a trivia question for you. Which city in the U.S. has the most lighthouses? You might think it would be somewhere in Maine or maybe the San Francisco Bay Area, but you'd be wrong. It's actually Lake Havasu City here in Arizona. The show's Annika Klein tells us how it's possible for a desert city to have that claim to fame.
Okay, your definition of lighthouse may need to expand a little bit here. The 25 lighthouses around Lake Havasu on the border of Arizona and California are all smaller replicas of real lighthouses in the U.S. But make no mistake, these replicas are fully functional.
Our lights are Coast Guard approved, and they are navigational lights for safety up and down our lake and around our island.
Linda LaCour is treasurer with the Lake Havasu Lighthouse Club, the all-volunteer group that creates and maintains the lighthouses. LaCour says the club's founders created the first replica in 2000 because they were concerned about boating safety on the lake.
It's very, very dark at night here. We don't even have street lights other than, you know, a regular stoplight.
Before the lighthouses, Arizona Game and Fish had some range lights around the lake. Field supervisor Deanna Flager says the lighthouses helped fill in the gaps.
The lake is undeveloped for the most part in a lot of locations, and on those dark, moonless nights, those lights do a lot to help boaters navigate, particularly if they're unfamiliar with the lake.
It's an experience Ron Leeson knows well. He's been living on the lake since 1967.
And until you've been lost after dark 10 or 15 miles down lake, you don't realize how much you need things like lighthouses. And you just get down there and there's no full moon, you're stuck.
Thousands of boats sail along the 30-mile stretch of water during peak season within the ring of these blinking lights. Replicas of West Coast lighthouses line the western shore, while East Coast replicas sit on the eastern side and Great Lakes lighthouses are on the island. They stand from 12 to 30 feet tall, dotted with miniature windows.
It gives you a certain feeling of safety, and they help provide a navigation at night.
It costs a few thousand dollars to construct one, and the upkeep can get expensive. LaCour says those Coast Guard-approved lenses are about $1,000 a pop, and sometimes they can't stand the heat.
They are solar-powered. Our only problem is they're good for 122 degrees. We have 125-degree days from time to time.
The downside to desert lighthouses. But many residents feel it's important to keep the lights on. That's why Ron Leeson is sponsoring the latest edition. It's a replica of Pigeon Point in California. For him, it'll brighten up the shore in more ways than one. He's dedicating it in memory of family members who have passed.
It'll be here forever. And it'll be something that we can look at and say, hey, there's our lighthouse. The lighthouse is very visible from the lake, so going past, we'll be able to say hi.
The Pigeon Point Lighthouse replica was dedicated this morning, bringing the total to 25. And the club plans to add one more within the next year. It's the show. I'm Annika Klein.
Valley musician Kate Brennan has been playing music for decades, but she only recently released her debut album, Debutante, just before her 47th birthday. Her music is a rich glam rock, full of layered vocal harmonies, catchy hooks, and a driving drum beat. Brennan grew up near Bell Road and 19th Avenue, which at the time was on the outskirts of town. We invited her in to talk about her new album, how being openly trans affects the way people perceive her and her music, and about the way the local music scene influenced her. She says she remembers listening to local bands like the Jetsons and Gentlemen After Dark and falling for them at a young age.
I was a very odd kind of misfit child out there in the boonies, and my family was in, still are in, horse racing and those kinds of things. And it was a very kind of westerny, it was not like your hip, strange, weirdo David Bowie kind of scene, you know? And so Gentlemen After Dark, you know, especially Brian Smith, the lead singer of Gentlemen After Dark, he had that kind of Bowie quality. And the idea that these artists were not in London, but were like 5 or 10 miles from here, and they were doing good and interesting and cool work right here, it gave me the idea, hey, maybe I don't have anything, and I don't have any fancy clothes or synthesizers or anything like that, but they're not far from here, and maybe I can do that too.
Dear author, no, I don't mean to be a baller, but every day's been like a slaughter since your departure.
When you are on stage, let's say mid to late teens, what sort of reception did you get?
It varied dramatically. you know, for the most part, I have a kind of an interesting sound, and my particular influences and the things that sort of I draw on, whether intentionally or unintentionally, tend to be of a certain kind of singer-songwriter, a certain kind of artist, you know, the sort of Nilsson Bowie kind of Beatles backline like that. And so we're talking about like my teen years, sort of the late 80s, early 90s, and there were certainly people who enjoyed that kind of music, but it had not become what it has become today. As far as gender in my music and my art, some people were fine with it, and other people were not fine with it. And of course, there were incidents where the people being not fine with it, you know, mixed with alcoholic beverages and so on, they would take that not fine with it out on my face a little bit. Mm-hmm. which, you know, it's one of those things where first, why did that really happen? And then it becomes discouraging. And when they're not enjoying it to your face with with a sock, and you're thinking, well, no one can even hear what I'm doing because of the gender. You know, they're only hearing or seeing, oh, transgender person. Right. Oh, so they're totally, like,
the
they're not
lost,
even
yeah.
listening to anything that I do after that. And so that's something that always bothered me and kind of kept me. I took an extended break after that and did a lot of my music privately for myself.
Say goodbyes and dry your eyes. Harmony lies inside of your blind. Don't ever leave it undefended.
So then what got you back publicly really wanting to play your music for people again?
I think the first thing was when my father passed away. He was a musician as well, but he had his problems, and he, you know, got into drugs and got into some other problems and eventually had cancer, and, you know, because of his lifestyle, had not caught it until it was too late. So we had a very limited amount of time together at that point. And I had never played him any of my music at that point. I had kept it from him as well because I didn't think he would care. And we took one trip to Sedona in the last few weeks of his life, and I decided that I would, you know, play him a few things on the way up. He was blunt in his day, and if he didn't like it, he would let you know. But he actually was very complimentary, and he said, why didn't you share this sooner? And so I told him the different things that had happened, and he said, you can't keep this. You can't keep this in a drawer. You need to share this with the world. And so that was the beginning. I didn't know how to do it, but I knew that I needed to do it at that point.
And it seems like a good decision, huh?
Well, I hope so. I hope so. I hope it has been.
I want to close with this, Kate, because you and I are around the same age. We're both past 40. We'll admit that to the audience. So how does it feel to do this? You've had this in your soul for 3 decades, let's say, maybe more than that. How does it feel to finally have this product, this CD, in debutante that people can hold and they can take it home, they can listen to it themselves.
It is an amazing feeling. It's a little surreal. It's very gratifying. We cashed out our pickle jars full of quarters that my grandmother had left me when she passed away and all this kind of things. We took all this money to the bank. They loved us at the bank when we showed up with $800 in rolled coins. I'm sure they still have our picture up. But we took that as seed money and started the album. And then when I came home, we had to turn to Kickstarter to see if we could get it pressed. People I knew, people I didn't know from my entire life came out to make this happen. And I had no idea anybody cared. And that moment was the moment that I realized that this wasn't a fantasy or a dream anymore, that this was something that I wanted, something that people wanted. So to have it be where people can physically hold the product and listen to the music wherever you are, it's beyond a dream come true. Agony answers, what you gonna do?
Love is the answer, baby, will I do? Valley singer-songwriter Kate Brennan. Her new album is called Debutante. Kate, thanks.
Thank you.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.